The views expressed on the following program are those of the hosts, callers, and guests, and are not necessarily those of WMEL staff, management, or advertisers.
This is Bold Talk Business Radio. Ladies and gentlemen, the CEO of Bold Marketing Solutions, Donna Anselmo.
Good afternoon. This is Donna Anselmo, and we are listening to Bold Talk Business Radio. You're doing the listening. I'm doing the talking with my guests today. Bold Talk Business Radio is the show where every edition that we put on is insightful, and it's designed to inform, educate, and inspire you to take the bold steps that you need to take to bring your business and your life to the level you want it to be at. Every week, my expert guests and I discuss topics that will help you choose the types of steps and the plans that you need to make to propel yourself and your business or career to the next level. Did you know that you take your personal self with you everywhere you go? It sounds obvious, but a lot of times we don't think about what's going on in our heads that leads us around to making the decisions that we make and the choices that we make in our lives. So when you have a mindset in your personal life, it carries over to your business life. And we want you to think about that while we're talking about how you can shift from one mindset to the other, whether you're talking about your personal business life or your professional business life. Basically, what people do is they have thoughts and beliefs and information and attitudes that guide them through the decisions that they make. So what I want you to take away from today's segment is that your inner self is going to lead you to some inner choices that you're going to make and the outer actions that you're going to take to work with you every day. Now, Bold Talk Business Radio is about bold thinking and strategies that will get you out of ruts and get you to live the life that you really want to lead. Every week, I bring you bold business experts who help me to deliver insights, strategies, tips, and tools to you for your own success. And my guest experts share their own bold new thinking, bold business strategies, and best business practices for their own success and for yours as well. So tune in with us every week between 2 and 3 on Bold Talk Business Radio to learn some new things and to stay on the path of continuous learning that makes better things happen in business and life. Today, we're speaking with attorney Russell Weigel, who's an investment attorney based in Miami, Florida, and he wrote the book Capital for Keeps: Limit Litigation Risk While Raising Capital. You can find his book at capitalforkeeps.com. That's www.capitalforkeeps.com. Attorney Russell Weigel, will you tell me why you wrote that book?
Yes. Thank you, Donna, for having me on the show again.
Love it.
And first, I just want to make sure it's clear that what we're discussing is purely educational in nature. We're not giving legal advice on the show. I'm not here specifically as an attorney. It's my background as an attorney, but I'm really here as the author. And so why did I write the book? I wrote the book based on my legal career, my experiences, and perceiving the economic environment that occurred after 2008, where large numbers of people started becoming unemployed. Perhaps mid-career, many people were displaced and were struggling financially. And in that environment, a lot of them became entrepreneurs. And in the course of being an entrepreneur, many of these folks just had no training, no backgrounds whatsoever in running a business, much less trying to raise capital for their businesses. And in my world, which is the securities law field, the regulated securities law industry, the regulated securities industry, it's superimposed on all financial transactions in a way that the rules and laws that apply to capital raising also are going to apply to these nascent corporations that are being started. And so my concern was, and what I'm trying to do is educate people with the book about the risks that they face because they're trying to do what most people would think is an ordinary and routine thing of raising capital. But understanding that when they do it, they're doing it in a highly regulated environment for which there are substantial penalties that apply to even innocent mistakes.
So capital raising is actually a complicated business that most people, because they're new to it, don't realize. And so if we're thinking about starting a business and we're looking to raise money, or maybe we're a business who has a few million dollars in the bank already. We've been in business for a while, but we have a new project coming up and we need to fundraise for that. Let's talk a little bit about some of the things that people can think about in terms of the options that they should be writing down and saying, these are the things I need to do before I get myself in trouble.
Well, I think that the first option, in my view, I think is the only option. That is planning and planning and planning, consulting many advisors, your accountants, lawyers, business coaches, putting together your team and trying to ascertain where are the chinks in the armor in our mindset and in our approach to doing business that are going to end up or may expose us to risks that we hadn't contemplated. And so for those that are contemplating raising capital and essentially entering into my world, these kinds of steps are essential in my view to not only being able to seek and obtain investment or to obtain interest from potential investors, but to do it in a way that's not going to also give the investors too much of an opportunity to topple the company if for whatever reason they become unsatisfied.
So that makes me think about a company that has to start by saying first, well, what are we about? What are we trying to accomplish? And what's really important to us here?
Well, that's right. I think that the first step is self-analysis and the management of the company, the management of the business. We're talking about all businesses of all sizes, essentially, here. It could be the beauty parlor, the small business down the street. It could be, the larger corporation. But basically, whatever stage they're at, is to analyze the strengths of your company's people to start with. What are their backgrounds? What are their business experiences, if any, and take a look at that. There may be things that, as you do that process, you find out there are problems with people's backgrounds that, you might not like to have to disclose later on. Those can be issues. Better to know them up front than later on. And I think the second thing is to then figure out, well, you have to know your purpose. You have to have a business plan, and it has to be, I think, a written plan so you've well vetted and thought through how you're going to execute your business operations. That leads into determining what you think your cash needs are. And once you figure out what your cash needs are, then, that's a good time to think about, or it's really a very good way for the discussion with lawyers to commence, because that's when the type of capital that you're or the amount of capital that you're trying to seek can be formulated into a way that complies with different exemptions from the registration requirements that all investment transactions must comply with.
So how might a business go about looking for a qualified investor? And we're going to also answer that question, Russell. I think it's important for our listeners to know what makes a qualified investor for your business.
Well, I think the third leg of the taking the inventory is assessing who do you know that has money that's willing to take a chance on your business. And usually the answer for most small businesses is going to be, my friends and my family. And, you know, we've discussed in previous shows that your friends, you know, oftentimes for most people, they're not going to be so wealthy. And, you know, a relatively small percentage of the business owners and entrepreneurs are going to have substantially wealthy friends that can really afford to bankroll them. Most people don't have that access, and that's what led to the, in part anyway, to the creation of the Jumpstart Our Business Startups Act of 2012, where different rules than had ever been in place before allowed small companies, particularly, to solicit investors in using the technological advance or availability of social media, frankly, and other mechanisms, which had previously been illegal. Because the idea here was, if you don't know wealthy people, well, you can reach out to millions of people through social media very inexpensively. People are doing that. They're advertising that way anyway. Why not do your capital raise in the same way?
I want to pick up on this, Russell. I also want our listeners to know to stay tuned, because we have a young gentleman in the office with us today, Preston Tyvich, who is raising money for his company, J-Con Systems, jconsystems.com, and they're in the electrical hardware space and electrical development, manufacturing, and design space, and they have some interesting new products. As they're developing their business, they need an influx of capital. So Preston's going to stay with us. He's in the studio with us now, and he's going to be speaking with us later about what he's doing, and Russell is going to be able to provide some insight and help him think about some of the things that are important to him so that he limits the litigation risk of his company going forward. So we're going to be talking with Preston in a few minutes. In the meantime, one of the things that you brought up, Russell, a few minutes ago was knowing the background of the people who are investing for you. What might disqualify somebody from investing in your company? What do you want to watch out for, or what if the SEC found out that you had solicited money from a particular person who wasn't really qualified, what type of person might that be?
Well, I think, I'm not sure if there were two questions there, but one of them is what is the qualification of the investor?
Right.
And in that regard, the SEC divides the world up into accredited investors and unaccredited investors. And unaccredited investors are most people. And accredited investors, by contrast, are those that qualify under either an asset test or an income test. The asset test being having, at the time of their proposed investment, $1 million in liquid net worth. So that would exclude the value of their personal residence, would include perhaps the value of a second home, but not the personal, not the primary residence. And the income test, which is for individuals, $200,000 in income going back 2 years prior to the time of the investment, or including the income of the spouse. And then that test is $300,000.
So if a company wants to protect itself, and I'm changing gears here for a moment, if a company wants to protect itself and it's doing planning in advance of a raise-up, what type of documentation should the company be putting together?
Well, there are lots of things there's a huge amount of information that companies probably need to organize and have available. Because investors, they should have access, and they should be able to get access to all of the information about your company that they would think is important to their investment decision. So, you know, what does that mean? I mean, that means perhaps, you know, up to an extent your files, and before you do that, obviously you're going to want to be organized, and there are many different types of documents that evidence different transactions the company's doing, their major leases, could be major supply agreements, you name it, that investors may want to see. And you want to have that information well organized and available, because the more organized that you look, first of all, the less chance that you're going to make mistakes just in your operations if you're internally organized. But you're also going to make a better impression on prospective investors.
So one of the things that I noticed in your book, Capital for Keeps, Limit Litigation Risk While Raising Capital, Russell Weigel, is that when a company is planning that prospectus, they want to have company background that discusses the start and date of their incorporation and some routine background information on the company. The company also, I believe, based on having read your book, is that there are some risk factors that the company needs to disclose. What are some of the things that a company who is raising money needs to disclose to potential investors?
Well, they have to disclose all material facts. And that's the good facts and the bad facts. And that goes back to the notion of taking inventory of your people. In the book, for example, I have in the appendix a questionnaire that I use. And it's the questionnaire I use. And it's, I believe, pretty thorough. And it covers a lot of different elements of each person's work history, their education, and their investments, and essentially who they're doing business with. Because all of these things could be items. Actually, all of the information that's in the questionnaire is stuff that would be disclosable were the company a public company. And so I use it in all transactions, for example, so that people are always preparing themselves for one day being that public company. But in any case, both scenarios, private or public, involve being able to provide the information that's relevant to investors.
Russell Weigel, what I really like to hear here on AM 1300 WMEL, the Talk to Me station, and Bold Talk Business Radio particularly, is the best practices that people should follow so that the smaller companies that maybe haven't had the experience can still follow what works and what doesn't work based on what bigger companies who have been there before, done that, gone through the bootstrap process and built and built and built and have achieved the success. So today, one of the concerns that I think I'm hearing is that the small business needs to really do its diligence, make the checklist, follow the strategies, read the book, get the information that you need, and really get very process-oriented so that you don't make mistakes.
That's right. It's all a process. It is all time-consuming. It's an administrative headache. But every business has these same issues. And, there's – depending on the book – covers, it's not unique to any specific industry or a business, but there's a due diligence checklist in the back of the book, which covers a lot of territory in terms of different items that the companies, if they have them, they should keep organized and make those available to prospective investors. Those are the kinds of things that companies in their ordinary operations probably should just routinely keep track of.
Mm-hmm. So you're talking about things like the articles of incorporation, the company locations, the jurisdictions where you have substantial business contacts, list of subsidiaries, affiliates, and minority holdings of the company, who is on the company's board of directors, I'm assuming?
Yeah, there's a long list of potential documents that a company may or may not have, and if they have transactions that they know they've done them, but if they have done them, they ought to be looking out for some of these documents and make sure they've got them organized and available. And that's just basic record keeping.
What about the documentation of human capital? Who's there in the company? How do you recommend that people vet the people in their company so that they know that the potential investor is going to be interested in doing business with them?
Well, the checklist that I have in the appendix of the book is a questionnaire really for management. And, ordinary employment hiring probably does not go into the same level of detail that the questionnaire does. But the more routine hiring probably involves something along the lines of background checks being conducted for companies that are prudent. That, you know, they want to make sure that, because why do people apply for a job? They want money, and hopefully the company's going to get the work and skill set out of those people that the employees say they have and the employee believes it needs. But at the end of the day, you have two parties coming into a transaction, and the company probably ought to not take the word of the applicant, at the end of the day, just
without
verifying,
right? Absolutely. So we're going to be talking a little bit more in the next segment about some specific example with Preston Tivich and JCOM Systems and the new product that he is going to tell you about on our upcoming segment after the break. We have about 2.5 minutes to go in this first segment, Russell. And one of the things I wanted to ask you about that I know is important is what's going on in the regulatory climate now, and what are you thinking needs to change to give more flexibility to businesses in raising money?
Well, this is, I guess, a commentary on Washington, D.C., if you will. And in the past 15 years or so, there have been just huge legislative changes made to the laws that affect company financing. And they've come from both sides of the aisle. Republicans have done a lot of damage. The Democrats have done a lot of damage. And at the end of it, middle America, the small business community, has been taking the brunt of huge quantities of regulations that have been created as a result of this legislation. And so now, the burden and the expense is become stifling in the minds of many. And now there's a pushback, I think, more by the people about, what can we do to alleviate all of this, all these requirements that are being imposed upon us.
So we're going to come back to that conversation. I know that I've been reaching out to Congressman Posey because we'd like to get him on to talk a little bit about what's going on in the business community and the legislative community as well. And we will be back in a few minutes with you and Preston Tivich and Russell Weigel. This is
This is Bold Talks Business Radio. Ladies and gentlemen, the CEO of Bold Marketing Solutions, Donna Anselmo.
This is Donna Anselmo, returning to Bold Talk Business Radio today with attorney Russell C. Weigel from Miami, Florida, who joins us in the studio once a month on the last Saturday of every month when we are talking about how to keep the capital that you raise for your money, for your business. And today we also have in the studio with us Preston Tivich, who is the Director of Business Development for JCONSystems.com. Preston, tell us a little bit about JCONSystems.com. We're going to be leading into the fundraising arena, but let us know a little bit about the background of your company, who you are and what you do.
Sure. Well, thanks again for having me on, Donna. Am I close enough here? This is good? Okay,
that's
cool.
Good.
So JCONSystems began its life as an electronic component distributor for the student and hobbyist community, mostly around FIT's campus, and started in 2011. And over the years, we've evolved into a full service product design firm. So we basically help people bring their ideas to life at whatever stage they may be at. So anywhere from concept development to prototyping to manufacturing and even in some cases to distribution.
So you have a new product that you are personally out there representing. You're going to investor fairs and you're speaking with people who are qualified investors. You're looking at investment capital. Tell us a little bit about the new project that you're bringing to light and why you're raising money for it.
Sure. So Internet of Things is a big buzzword right now, and that's just basically how do we connect what used to be dumb, like, say, a bag or a key ring or something like that, how do we connect it to the rest of the world? So our new product is called the Hero Thing Finder, and what it is you attach it to things you typically lose track of, like your keys or your notebook or your remote, and you actually can open up an app on your phone that you can buzz the unit to see, let's say your keys fell under your couch or something, it'll ring, it'll help you find it. It also tells you roughly how far away you are from it as well. And let's say you leave something at work, like your suitcase. Once you get out of range of your suitcase, the phone will actually remember the last known GPS location where it saw the Thing Finder unit. So
first thing I'd like to say is, although it's the Hero Thing Finder, I want to spell Hero for people who might be looking for this. It's H-I-R-O. Right?
Yes, ma'am.
And I think that there are a lot of us out there, I know me in the studio particularly, who every day is looking for my keys, so I can see why it's applicable, which is one of the things that an investor would be looking at, you know, who's going to want it. Because at the end of the day, the people who are looking to invest in your company and who will be looking to invest in your company aren't doing it just for fun. They're doing it because they're business people, and in the end, they want to make money with it too. So tell me a little bit about what you have been doing to reach out to investors to date.
So to fund the initial things in our design, basically to finalize the design, we took it to crowdfunding first. We were well equipped for that with our team and our expertise up to that point with Kickstarter. So we raised $30,000 on Kickstarter from 863 backers. I think that worked out to roughly 2,500 units pre-sold. So that was really nice for us because it gave us a little bit of that early capital to be able to make the injection molds and also to do our first run of manufacturing. Because obviously for us, you know, the first thing is to get the units actually made and in people's hands, right? So the Kickstarter money allowed us to basically manufacture a lot of 5,000, which we're currently in the process of doing. So half of that will go to our backers themselves, and then the other half will go to, you know, sort of organically growing through direct sales. So we have that approach. We're also developing relationships with angel investors and venture capitalists as par for the course for our J-Con business. So, you know, developing relationships with capital investors like that tends to be a good strategy if you're going to ask money from them later. So it's just been mostly in that sort of stage of meeting new people and expanding our network. And we're also participating in a lot of different tech events. We're doing the General Merchandising Show in Orlando in May. We're doing Project One Spark coming up here in Jacksonville, and which is actually more like a Kickstarter in person. It's a crowdfunding festival is what they call it. We're also going to be doing TomTom Founders Fest in Charlottesville, Virginia. So it's a mixture of developing relationships, doing crowdfunding, and then actually hitting the streets, you know, boots on the ground style, getting the word out and getting exposure.
So two things that I'd like our listeners to know and to be clear about is the Hero product that Preston Tezvich is talking about is a small disc that looks like a tag that you put right onto your key ring. And then once it's on the key ring, you just go to your phone, and with your cell phone and the app, you can locate the missing keys, correct?
Correct, yeah. It's about the size of a dog tag. That's exactly the form factor we were going for.
So if you also lose your phone, what do you do?
So there's actually a button on the Thing Finder itself as well. So it's a two-way tracker. So if you lose your phone, which is about as common as you losing your keys, you can press the button on the device and it'll actually beep your phone, even if your phone's on silent. So it won't hide from you.
And can you access the platform from the internet itself on a computer?
Not
currently. Or is it only mobile?
Not currently. And that's our first focus was to get a low-cost, robust, feature-reliable product to market and then build a lot of this back-end stuff and new products as we go, because that's within our expertise in our J-Con business.
So Russell Weigel's with us in the studio, as he was in the last segment, and Preston Tezvich has brought up the discussion about Kickstarter. I know what Kickstarter is, but Preston, why don't you tell our listeners out there, because you're a young internet savvy fellow, but everybody who listens to talk radio doesn't necessarily spend their life on the internet. So talk a little bit about what Kickstarter is so our listeners can understand, and then I'm going to ask Russell to comment on it.
Sure, yeah. So Kickstarter is a crowdfunding platform. So basically people post up essentially a project page. It's almost like a Facebook profile, but imagine it's for a particular project instead. And people make a video that's real quick that can kind of demonstrate what they're looking to do. And they basically ask the community at large for a particular amount of money. So let's say for us it was actually $5,200, which was pretty on the low end. You actually only get funded on Kickstarter if you actually reach that level or exceed it, right? So, for example, there's the most popular Kickstarter so far is Pebble Time, and this actually of all time. They have over 75,000 backers. They asked for $500,000, and they're at almost $20 million. So Kickstarter is basically a way where, you know, a small company can get the funding that they need to actually put their product in people's hands. So you can almost look at it as like a pre-sale thing, as if you were buying something on Amazon.com, but the ship date was a few months from when you purchase it, right? So you're basically pre-ordering a unit that doesn't quite yet exist. And Kickstarter acts as basically a billboard for a project and a tally system for donations.
Okay, so the donation is done in advance. And what does the Kickstarter participant, the Kickstarter funder, get for sending you money?
So it depends on how people structure their reward levels. So people can give different amounts of money to a campaign. So in our situation, you know, $14 bought one hero thing finder, and so on and so forth. So when people give, you know, whatever their funding level is, they receive whatever that backer level is set to. So in some cases, we gave, you know, two hero thing finders at a discount. I think, I'm not sure what the numbers were, but something around $20. So the backers basically get what they pay for. Once we actually go to start fulfilling it.
Right. And so that gives you the startup capital that you need to begin your manufacturing based on faith because people liked your concept.
Bingo.
Okay. So, Russell Weigel, what do you think about crowdfunding? You come from an investment background. You've worked for the SEC. You know what the concerns are for bringing in money and doing it under the legal structure and legal limits of the law.
Well, I commend Preston and his company for using the Kickstarter model. They seem perfectly situated for that kind of endeavor, and I like it because it's, I think, an appropriate use of social media. It's an appropriate use of internet media to advertise your company and to try to obtain donations or pre-funded purchases or pre-purchases, I guess, of your product line, which enables the company to develop their products and get them out to market without having to get the financing for that same endeavor from investors or from banks, perhaps. So they're relying on their future customer base, making them a present customer base to generate and grow organically, and I love that because it's the safest thing to do, I think, relative to seeking investors, that is. And the other big benefit about doing that is that they're not giving up any equity in their company at all, which is what they're certainly going to do at some point. Quite often is the result for most companies that are seeking investor financing are going to be giving up some equity position. And so I think the way they're going about it is great, because if they can continue to grow organically, to continue to just grow through their own revenue and their appropriate use of it, use of the revenue within the company, then the longer they can push off seeking outside funding from investors, the less percentage of the company they may one day give away to investors if they do go that route of equity funding. And that leaves more for the founders. And you know, hopefully their company will be more valuable, you know, at that point in time. So I think it's great. Crowdfunding has many connotations in this context, in the Kickstarter context. We're talking about getting funds from the crowd to pre-fund the purchase of a product. And there is a statute on the books that's been on the books since 2012. I mentioned it earlier, the Jumpstart Our Business Startups Act of 2012, which has a crowdfunding statute within it. And that type of crowdfunding is called investment crowdfunding. And that's where the company would be going out looking for small amounts of capital from a broad range, a broad array of potential investors. And that's a different type of crowdfunding than Preston is talking about. But the words are often used interchangeably. People refer to crowdfunding. Some mean it to be the either the donation type of crowdfunding or the pre-purchase style, and others mean it to be the investment style. And today, as of March 28th, 2015, investment crowdfunding is still illegal. So there's a statute on the books, but until the SEC comes out with the regulations that will implement it, doing that kind of crowdfunding is still illegal. This was a big week for the SEC, perhaps for many that are looking for capital, because on March 25th, the SEC did finally come out after 3 years almost with regulations to implement the Regulation A plus statute that was part of the Jobs Act. So little by little, the SEC has been implementing it. But the one thing that they haven't done, and the one that they're taking the longest to do, obviously, is to implement the investment crowdfunding.
This is Donna Anselmo. You're listening to AM 1300 WMEL, the Talk to Me station. This is Bold Talk Business Radio. We are here with investment attorney Russell C. Weigel and Preston Tezvich, who is the Director of Business Development for JCON Systems and a co-founder, co-developer of Hero. So, Preston, we've been talking a little bit about your product, which is a thing finder, an electronic thing finder. Tell our customers, our listeners out there, maybe your customers, what and how your product actually works, the Bluetooth technology.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, so you can almost think about it like a lighthouse. You can only see a lighthouse from so far away, you know, and it's basically all about signal strength, right? So this unit's basically a beacon. You know, you don't see it. It's not in light. It's called Bluetooth, right? So it's basically the same frequency that your phone uses in a lot of cases, right? So it's a beacon that goes for about 150 feet. And anything in the area that has the app installed, so like a phone or a tablet or something like that, is always looking for that beacon. And if it sees that beacon, it'll be able to connect with that unit. And so that connection is how the magic happens. So if you're looking for your keys, that connection allows your phone to send, you know, a piece of information to the device to tell it to ring. So it'll ring. It'll also, based on the signal strength, give you a rough estimate on how far away you are from it, sort of like a warmer, colder type of method of finding it. And once it stops being able to see that beacon at all, then the phone marks the last known location of the GPS. So that's functionally how the unit works. I'm not sure how much more detail you want me to get into.
That's pretty good. I wanted to distinguish for our listeners also that it's not actually a GPS system. It's not
correct.
Global positioning system. It works by a Bluetooth beacon. Tell me a little bit about when you were using Kickstarter and you used it basically as a source of funding, what were you able to find out in terms of feedback from the community that influenced your decision making about your business?
That's a really good question. You know, for one, I guess it's nice because you can kind of gauge the community interest. And we weren't the first of that type of product on Kickstarter, so we already knew that there was going to be a lot of interest. But it's nice to be able to see people's immediate feedback on your product design. So things like, oh, I like, you know, the form factor of it, or different suggestions for features, or things like that. So getting sort of that open source feedback method can really help you iterate quickly. And in fact, after our Kickstarter, because of some of the comments from some of the backers of other products and things like that, it helped us get some ideas on how we can redesign a few components to make them a lot more reliable and a lot more user-friendly. So that feedback is great for iteration. You can produce a better product a lot faster when you have immediate consumer engagement like that.
So talking about the production of your product from concept to reality, what were some of the biggest challenges that you faced in moving your business forward? I see you laughing, and I guess there are a few.
So if you ever run a Kickstarter, always just like however much time you think it's going to take you to fulfill it, double that, and then you know just expect that it's always going to take longer to do all of the nuanced work of manufacturing and design. There's a lot of little things that go into things like injection molding, circuit board assembly, you know, how this buzzer works versus this other buzzer. And it's that general idea of what can go wrong will. That's typically how that works whenever you're designing a product. You know, it's tough because you're typically navigating a very unfamiliar landscape. Every new project has, you know, kind of the sky's the limit approach to it. So it's interesting as you go through that.
Yeah, I can just about see the smiles and the nods on the faces of all the engineers in our Melbourne and Brevard County community out there acknowledging that that is the case. Whatever can go wrong will go wrong. Whatever you didn't anticipate is going to happen. And whatever you did anticipate is going to happen, probably amplified.
Definitely.
Russell, what do you find in terms of the challenges? We're talking with Russell C. Weigel, investment attorney, in terms of the expectations and challenges that the business leader who's looking for investment in his company really needs to take into account.
What are the challenges and expectations? Well, I guess I've seen a range of people over the years from the somewhat wide-eyed, you know, thinking that they've created some amazing contribution to mankind that is not, I mean, you know, going to be well-received by anybody, frankly, to companies that are well along and have been in business for years and have, I don't know, certainly ups and downs in their revenues, but you know, have a product line that is substantial and is probably being tweaked over time. And so what are the expectations? They range commensurately. The more seasoned folks probably have lower expectations, and the less seasoned ones don't know what they don't know, and they just think that, I mean, to their credit, everything is possible, and let's go for it. And you know, some will survive, and you know, many will get a reaction from the marketplace that they didn't expect.
Thank you, Russell Weigel. Preston Tezvich, you have launched a successful, I'd say you would call your Kickstarter campaign pretty successful, got you off the ground, and now you're looking at some additional venues that you're going to with your product and you're showing out to potential investors now. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the Project OneSpark? And also I'm going to ask you to piggyback onto that and tell me a little bit about your pitch series.
Sure. So OneSpark has been billed as essentially the world's largest crowdfunding festival. I believe last year the numbers that they published were something along the neighborhood of 260,000 attendees in Jacksonville, Florida. And it's basically a venue where I believe there's, I think there's 500, I suppose, projects this time around. And it's the way you can think about it as a Kickstarter in person. So there's a booth. You know, you're at your booth, you have people coming by, and instead of charging an admission fee, the whole OneSpark puts forth the ethos of, you know, instead of paying that money to tickets, pay that money to projects that you like, that you want to support. So it's complete with backer levels and, you know, just very standard, just like Kickstarter. There's also $3.5 million of VC financing on the table as well that people are applying for that we also apply to as well.
So, Attorney Russell Weigel, what should JCon Systems, a company like his company, like Preston Tezvetch's company, look for, in the event that they go to one of these fundraisers and somebody comes up to him and says, you know what, I've got a pocket full of money here and I want to invest in your company, what's the first concern that he should have?
Who is this person? And I think that I talk about this topic in my book. You know, I'm highly concerned about investors, not investors, but company executives being too focused on the cash being dangled before them and not looking at who's dangling it. And so, you know, my suggestion and recommendation in the book is simply, you know, vet them as much as anybody else, because the cash may look cheap now because it's right there and you don't have to hunt for it, but it may cost you a lot more in the long run. So look before you leap.
And I'm going to ask a question. What else? Because there's always one more thing to watch for. What else should he be aware of? The look before you leap, the who is the investor. What is the biggest concern that he should have before taking investor money?
Well, I think, I mean, there's all kinds of things to consider in doing that. But the venture capital scenario is one that probably involves giving up not only an equity position, a substantial equity position in the company, but probably also some significant management control. And so, you know, in the book, I actually say that the angel investor is probably the benefactor the most companies are looking for, not the VC type.
Okay, well, I want to thank Russell Weigel for being in the studio with us this week at Bold Talk Business Radio, and Preston Tezvetch, JCon Systems, jconsystems.com. And if you want to reach out and find Russell's book on the internet, you're going to go to www.capitalforkeeps.com. You can find me at boldmarketingsolutions.com. And I ask you to come back next week and listen to Bold Talk Business Radio. We're going to have author Jeff Goins on the air with us.